Breadbox Media Programming is brought to you by CMN Momentum 2020 Online is the unique event for ministry-minded Catholics. Join us July 15th and 16th and jumpstart your good work for God. This two-day event offers best practice conference presenters and a virtual trade show. Also included are film screenings, music guests, and even a pro-life voter town hall. CMN is where Catholic businesses and nonprofits, leaders and volunteers, are empowered with practical hope and help during these hard times. Visit CatholicMarketing.com and register today. Your Catholic organization can join Catholic Marketing Network so you and four members of your team can attend Momentum 2020 for free. In addition to free access, a $75 CMN membership provides year-round benefits for Catholic schools, nonprofits, church fundraising teams, retailers, and more. Visit CatholicMarketing.com and register, and get ready to build professional and personal momentum.
Socks, the Catholic book blogger. Today we have with us John DeRosa. He is a high school teacher and the host of the Classical Theism podcast. He lives in New Jersey with his wife Christine, and he is the author of the book we'll be speaking about today, One Less God Than You, How to Answer the Slogans, Cliches, and Fallacies the Atheists Use to Challenge Your Faith. Welcome to the show, John.
Thanks, Pete. It's a pleasure to be here.
So I guess out of the gate, let's start with this question. What was your goal for this particular book?
Now, it's a good question. I'll tell a brief story. I was a chaperone at a ninth grade confirmation retreat for my parish, just, you know, volunteer chaperone. And when I went there, I was expecting, all right, these are eighth and ninth graders ready to make their confirmation. They're probably all gung-ho about the faith, or at least, you know, committed Catholics and ready to make that final step. But what I was struck by is how many of them had a lot of questions about the faith, but were also struggling with these skeptical or atheistic slogans, such as, well, hey, I believe in God. There's no evidence. Or, you know, don't we believe in science? I learned all about science in school, and after all, science has disproved Christianity. Or, hey, you don't believe in any of those 2,000 other gods, like Zeus and Thor and Krishna, and I just believe in one less God than you. And I found that the ninth graders, either they were, you know, asking these as questions, or even some of them who were heading towards unbelief were giving these slogans themselves. So I'm like, wow, you know, not only are these prevalent on the internet, but they're coming up in a lot of different places. And I think it's important as Catholic Christians that we're ready to dialogue and engage, and that we don't just tell people to turn their brains off or just have faith or, hey, just trust us, don't look at those slogans. But no, we want to bring them substantial answers, and I wanted to equip Catholics to have better dialogues and better conversations when these slogans come up.
So you raise a very good point there, and it comes up in the book, but in that story as well, is that the atheist movement is getting these young people at an early age. What avenues are they using to accomplish this?
You know what? I think the internet is a big one, of course. You know, students nowadays, they're on social media, they're on YouTube, and they might see a quick video, they might see several memes that present these slogans and these ideas, and either they don't know who to consult or where to look for answers, or maybe they went to their parents, or they went to a priest or someone and asked them, and they got their questions kind of dismissed, and people didn't take them seriously. So I think it's a combination of hearing a lot of these slogans and YouTube videos and memes and social media. And also, we got to take some responsibility as Catholics. We haven't always been there to give the best answers. And if students are hearing this stuff from their friends or seeing it online and they don't think there's answers, they don't want to be looked on as stupid. They don't want to seem dumb. And so I think a lot of them can just drift away. So if we're ready to give better answers initially when they start to question, and I honestly, I think, you know, around fourth, fifth grade, middle school, these students have a lot of good questions about the faith that we want to engage intellectually. If we can give them some better answers and we know how to handle them, then that will hopefully sow the seeds for a richer religious life down the road.
You discuss five principles you give for interacting with atheists, and I think they're all very very good and very important because, you know, those conversations can become confrontational if we allow them to. And I want to cover those five principles a bit to give people some sense of the right direction to take. And the first principle you discuss is prayer. It's praying every day. How important is that to our success when we're trying to show an atheist or someone questioning their faith that the faith is
absolutely
the right answer?
You know, I it's the first principle I list because I think it's the most important, the most foundational. You know, we're taught it from when we're young. It's in the catechism, you know, that we should be setting aside a certain amount of time each day just to talk to the Lord and build on that relationship. And honestly, I am not an expert on prayer. I fail all the time. I'm not the best at it. But in order for us to be able to go out there and evangelize, we have to stay close to the Lord. So you might start by setting, you know, 10 or 15 minutes aside in the morning or at night. And then you kind of build on that. There's a lot of great people that talk about prayer. But if you don't pray, then I think what's going to happen is you're going to get very discouraged in these conversations, and you're not going to have that bedrock relationship to return to. So I think prayer with God, having that close relationship with Christ, when we have a difficult conversation, because, I mean, everybody knows it doesn't always go well. You might have a tough one at the Thanksgiving dinner table or with a friend or something else. That's not the end of the world. You have a bad conversation, you return to the Lord, you pray, you say, hey, Lord, what can I do better next time? How can I handle this situation differently? And then just by living your life as a deliberate Christian, you're going to draw people in. So I think prayer is the first foundation there to do that. And then, can I go to the second one?
Yeah, so the second one is, whenever possible, start by asking questions rather than making statements.
Yeah, and I found this to be important because what I see online, a lot of just back and forth and people yelling and getting upset with each other. It's just someone makes a claim like, oh, well, I don't believe in God because I believe in science, or there's no evidence for God. And then someone launches back like, what, are you an idiot? Did you ever hear of this? And they're like, no, well, you're dumb because you didn't hear this. And it just gets into it, you know, a shouting match. Tensions are high. People are upset. And I think you can just approach the situation entirely differently by starting with a question. Instead of thinking, and it also takes the pressure off yourself. Mm-hmm. I think a lot of Catholics are worried, like, oh my gosh, someone said this, and if they don't have the perfect answer right away, well then, you know, it's their fault that the church didn't get defended. And instead of that, I want to kind of change the paradigm that it's not your job to give a perfect answer. When someone makes a claim, you're going to start out by asking questions. Find out more of what they're saying. Make them do some of their homework. And the three foundational questions I give in the intro are just, ask a question, hey, what do you mean by that? How'd you come to that conclusion? And then third, you want to say, well, have you ever considered this? And if you've studied the issue yourself, you can offer something more for their consideration. And in particular, you know, someone says, well, science has disproved Christianity, or I don't believe in God, I believe in science. Well, before you start launching into something, just ask the person, well, hey, can you tell me what you mean by that? What do you have in mind? What's the incompatibility you see between believing in God and believing in science? Because I'm a Catholic and I love science. And then just invite them to tell you more about that before you go further in the discussion. So that is so, so important. And what I do in each of the 20 little chapters is I give you questions that you can ask in those different situations.
And just to segue off of that example you gave, probably the worst place you can get into a debate about anything, let alone the faith, is on social media. I mean, there's no filter there. The keyboard is terrible.
Yeah, and you know what? We have to train ourselves, too, because it's very tempting. And what I've used this questions thing on social media as well. So maybe you don't want to enter into like a back-and-forth debate and be up all night and stressed and anxiety about comments flying in and who's seeing this. But if you just take the approach of, well, I'm going to ask some good, solid questions and see what this person is thinking. And then maybe you say, give them a personal message. And you say, you know what? I disagree. I'm going to, you know, I think you're right on this point, but have you ever considered this? And then you can leave the conversation there and pick up at a different time. Don't think you have to have, you know, the perfect, fully fleshed out case right away. But one of my favorite things to do, honestly, on social media, almost I always just ask questions. And I try to avoid those heated arguments because you're going to make better headway in a face-to-face conversation. Mm-hmm. When people are behind a keyboard, they're much more willing to, you know, make derogatory comments, use inflammatory language, and just kind of look like, you know, they're the best. Whereas when you're face-to-face with a friend or someone you're just meeting, it's much more cordial and easier to have that dialogue.
Mm-hmm. And you move into the third principle, which is don't let people get away with vague, wishy-washy criticisms.
Yeah, I kind of already talked about that a little bit. And that's the idea, you know, oh, you know, you Christians, you just deny science. Or, oh, you Christians, there's this problem of evil, and that's why I don't believe in God. And they'll just kind of throw something out there passing and act like it carries the day. And this principle is don't let people get away with that. Make them do their homework. Ask them, well, hey, you know, have you ever considered any of the responses that Christians give to the problem of evil? Or, hey, have you ever, you know, looked into some of those issues between faith and science? Because I think they're actually perfectly compatible. Or, hey, how did you come to that conclusion? I heard what you said, but can you tell me more about your reasoning? I think a lot of people think they can get away with like a superficial meme or one-liner. And what I'm teaching Catholics to do in the book is that's not enough. You got to do your homework. You got to dig in. And if we've done some homework ahead of time, we can offer something more for their consideration.
Mm-hmm. Now, that leads me to another question. Do your homework ahead of time. I think one of the things that talked about this in an earlier episode with another author was about evangelization. And that is, you know, people are intimidated and afraid to evangelize because they don't understand their faith. But when you get into these situations where you're in a debate, what do you do? Because you could get backed into a corner and not have the answer.
Right. And I think what my book is going to do is give you tactics where you're going to be able to avoid feeling like you're backed into a corner. Because at the very worst, you can always just ask a question. And even if you get stumped, and I mentioned this towards the end of the interview, what if you're in over your head and you're absolutely stumped? You can always, you know, you can compliment the person and say, hey, that's a pretty good objection and a really good question. And sometimes kids even ask some of the best questions. I've never thought of that before, but I'm going to look into it and get back to you. Because as Catholics, we have a 2,000-year-old tradition, mm-hmm. and so many of the questions have been asked and answered in different ways. We just need to tap into it. So you do your best to do some homework ahead of time. You do your best to reason on the spot. You do your best to treat the person with respect and show them the love of Jesus Christ. But if you get stumped, it is not the end of the world. Conversions don't happen in one conversation. I think people, you know, get afraid because they expect evangelism to be like, I use this example once, like they're just bringing the sword of Gryffindor, like from Harry Potter, and they're just going to like stab their opponents and convert them on the spot in 10 seconds. And that's not how it works. People are much too complicated for that. The best we can do is, you know, show them respect, show them love, try to give them some good answers and follow up. Maybe they don't, you know, we have to get back to them with a good answer. Maybe we have to show them more in the future. Maybe we have to point them to a resource. But just because they don't convert on the spot, that is not a failed encounter. God can use the little steps throughout a person's life, maybe years, to lead them closer to himself. And we want to be, you know, a pebble in a person's shoe, a step along the way to help them embrace the faith.
Moving on to the fourth principle, that one is apologetics is most helpful to those who are already open to the truths of faith.
Yeah, and I'll just be brief with this one because I already kind of touched on it, and this is to get people to have realistic expectations. Mm. If you think you're just going to go out there and knock somebody over with your argument or with your experience or with your, you know, gospel preaching and that they're all just going to be convinced on the spot, that's not really realistic. And in my own experience, I found that apologetics and intellectual answers can actually be very helpful if the person is already open. And that means, you know, if they're pretty hostile, if they've had a really bad experience, they've been harmed in the past, or they're just like spewing anger and slogans and so forth, then you can expect to convince them right on the spot. Maybe you can ask some good questions, find out more of why they're hurt and what they're thinking, and say, hey, you know what, I'm sorry. We might have to apologize. You know, I'm sorry you were treated that way by those Christians in the past or even by, you know, a priest or by our church. But I just want to know that I want you to know that you're loved by God. I think he's got a great plan for your life. And I'd be happy to talk about you further in the future. And then what happens is once the person goes from like hostile to being slightly open, which comes about through grace and through the Holy Spirit over time, that's when the answers are going to be more helpful. So that's more of just, this is a principle that you're not going to necessarily bring out in conversation, but to yourself, to tell yourself and remind yourself, that, you know, you can't expect people to convert on the spot, and the answers will be helpful after the person's open. But if they're hostile and closed, you're not going to magically convert them. Only the Holy Spirit can do that.
Mm-hmm. And John, the fifth principle, don't neglect the soft skills of evangelism.
Yeah, that's just nobody wants to listen to a jerk. Nobody wants to be talked down to or told that, you know, they're stupid and you know all the answers. I'll tell you what, some of the most difficult people to evangelize are with family. You know, if I try to go to my brother and sister and say, hey, you should be doing this, and this is the right way, and blah, 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 they know me, they know my flaws, they've seen me fly off the handle, and people don't want to be talked down to, like, who is this kid? You know, now he went off and got enlightened, now he's going to tell us the right way. Mm-hmm. So instead of, you know, coming across like that, keep in mind that every person we meet is a treasure made in the image of God. We want to treat them with love and with respect. And even if they're hostile, even if they're a bit harsh, we don't want to return that in kind. We want to love them. And with that message, you know, or with that manner of our message, you have a better chance of the answers sinking in. Because you could give the best answers, but if you deliver them in the wrong way, you might just push people further away. So don't neglect those soft skills. I even recommend a secular book, Dale Carnegie's How to Win Friends and Influence People. He's got a bunch of great things on just how to be kind and genuine with others and to build those relationships. But yeah, no, don't neglect those soft skills. No one wants to listen to a jerk.
All right. We're going to take a quick break and we'll be back to discuss more of One Less God Than You. You've been listening to Off the Shelf here on Breadbox Media. We'll be right back.
Looking for exceptional coffee delivered fresh to your door? We have the answer. Our friends at Grim Bean Coffee produce small batch artisan coffee using top tier coffee beans. The coffee is roasted when you order, guaranteeing the freshest coffee possible. Check out Breadbox Roasts, a new line of Catholic themed coffees available at www.grimbeancoffee.com/Breadbox Media. Experience coffee like never before.
Welcome back to Off the Shelf. We're here with John DeRosa discussing his book, One Less God Than You, How to Answer the Slogans, Cliches, and Fallacies that Atheists Use to Challenge Your Faith. And John, in our second segment here, as we head to the end of the show, I'd like to highlight some of these slogans and maybe give us some guidance on how to tackle some of them if we're faced with them. And I think a popular one that many people hear is, you know, the first one you lead off with, and that is, there is no evidence for God's existence.
Yeah, and so what I want to teach people to do is to use those principles that we talked about, and whenever possible, start by asking a good question. When someone makes a bold assertion like this, like there's no evidence for God's existence, people think they need to trot out, you know, this big case right away and you know, just, what are you kidding me? There's no evidence, and I can think of all this different evidence. Before you do that, ask a question. I give people a few recommendations. Here's a good question you can ask. Well, hey, wait a minute. You say there's no evidence for God's existence. Can you tell me what's the best evidence you've heard, and what do you think is wrong with it? That way you can get into their mind a little bit and see what they've studied. They might come back to you and say, well, best evidence, I've never seen any evidence for God's existence. And that's kind of your cue to say, well, oh my gosh, I'm sorry that you've never heard any evidence, but I can think of, you know, three or four pieces of evidence right off the top of my head. And that's going to be based on your prior study. And I give examples in the book, like you could talk about the Kalam cosmological argument, contingency argument, fine-tuning argument, moral argument, but your own little list of evidence is going to be based on what you've studied. Perhaps you've studied the evidence for Jesus' resurrection. But the point is, you first want to start out by asking, what have you examined, and what do you think was wrong with it? Here's another answer they might give. They might say, well, you know, I've heard some evidence, like my friend told me he prayed for something once, and, you know, then he got a job. Or, you know, they might give something very subjective. And if they give that sort of answer, you can actually agree with them. You could say, hey, you know, that might be some evidence for your friend who that happened to, but I kind of agree with you. It's not really good, hard, objective evidence, but have you ever considered something like the Kalam cosmological argument or the fine-tuning argument that shows that the universe began to exist, that it has this beautiful order in it and points to a designer? Have you ever considered that? And then you're kind of in a back and forth about that evidence. And then the third type of answer they might give, and I kind of give a little flowchart here in this chapter. But the third type of answer they could say is, you know what, I have examined the evidence. I've examined, you know, the contingency argument for God's existence, and I think it commits the fallacy of composition. And that's an atheist that you need to compliment because he's clearly done his homework. And in that case, you could say, well, you know, I gotta give you some credit here. I appreciate that you've looked into these issues, you've taken them seriously. And if you know an answer, you can respond. And if you don't, you could say, that's a good objection. I haven't quite looked into that one, so let me find out more about it, and then I'll get back to you. But have you ever considered this other argument? Maybe you consider a different one that he hasn't looked at. So those are some of the questions I would ask in the beginning. Two principles I give, too, and I'll just close it off with this, is it's not really plausible that there's no evidence for God's existence when there's many highly trained scholars who have looked into the issue across centuries and millennia and defended them in peer-reviewed articles and books and all of our traditions. So it's not really a plausible claim. And another question you might ask someone is, well, hey, shouldn't we be open to examining evidence? I mean, you say there's no evidence. Is that really a possibility? Shouldn't we be open to examining? Here's what I'm getting at, Sue. A lot of times they have in mind only scientific evidence. I should have explained that first. They think there's no evidence because the only type of evidence there could be is the thing that you find in a laboratory under a microscope or, you know, through the scientific method. And that's where I would ask this question. I'd say, well, hey, I admit scientific evidence is one type of evidence, but shouldn't we be open to all kinds of evidence, like historical evidence or philosophical evidence? Like, shouldn't we have an open mind to all of that evidence? And then you're kind of off and running and can present some arguments for God, maybe talk about the resurrection of Christ or some Catholic miracles. But that's where I recommend people starting with the slogan, there's no evidence for God.
Now that came out of the section, popular slogans. You have a second section, serious slogans, and this one's a pretty tough one. And that is, anyone who walks into a children's hospital knows that God doesn't exist.
Yeah, that is a tough one. And I put these in the serious slogans list because there's four of them, and they actually point to very substantial arguments that atheists have made, and they're probably the serious ones, the most serious ones that we have to deal with. The problem of evil, the problem of divine hiddenness, I call it, the problem of why are there so many different religions. And although you can utter that in one sentence, like someone could just say, hey, anyone who walks into a children's hospital has to just know God doesn't exist because look at all that suffering. Although it takes them like 10 seconds to say that, it's actually tough and it can take a little bit longer to unpack it and give a good answer. So this is one of the longest chapters. Actually, I think it's the longest chapter, the one I deal with on the problem of evil. And I would start out by making some distinctions. First, you got to try to discern, is this person approaching the issue as an intellectual problem or is more of a pastoral difficulty, like someone who's going through something? Like if they try, and you may not come out and ask that, like you may not want to just say, hey, are you someone who's going through something or are you looking at an intellectual problem? That can be kind of awkward, but you can kind of discern, you know, are they talking about a personal experience? Like, hey, my nephew has cancer and just died. Where was God in that? If they're talking about something really personal and pastoral and emotional, I don't think the philosophical answers in that moment are really going to help them a lot. So in those cases, I would say, I would advise you to hold off on giving a full philosophical case and do your best just to love that person. If they're a Christian, encourage them to take refuge in the love of Jesus Christ. I mean, he became man. God became man in Christ Jesus, and he understands all of our suffering better than we could. So encourage them to go to Christ. I even point out, too, it's okay if they're angry and upset. In the Bible, there's people where it's actually in the inspired scripture. I give an example in the book Lamentations 3, where the writer of scripture, the believer, is actually complaining and really angry with God because of what's going on. And so if that's how they're feeling, that could be their prayer in the moment. You know, encourage them not to give up on God. Go to him. And if they have to complain and protest a bit, he's still there. He can take it. He's big enough. But if they're dealing with a pastoral difficulty, encourage them to take refuge in Christ. Try to be there as a good friend. Do what in the book of Job, you know, Job's friends, when they first get there, they just kind of sit with him and take solace with him and try to comfort him. Then things go off the wheels when they go off on tangents trying to explain the evil. That's if someone's dealing with a pastoral personal issue. So that's where I'd start.
Right.
Second, though, okay, what if you've got an atheist who actually wants the answers? They actually want to deal with the philosophical issues. You got to make a key distinction. And here's another distinction. There's something called the logical problem of evil, and then there's the evidential problem. You got to ask the atheist, hey, are you coming at this where you think it's logically impossible that God and evil can coexist in the world? Or are you more looking at it as evil provides evidence against God's existence that makes his existence unlikely, but it's not really an impossibility? And then I give you some tips for dealing with each of those rungs. I'll give a little bit here. If they're pressing the logical version, if they think it's logically impossible for God to exist and there to be evil and suffering in the world, I would point out a couple things. First, if we want to have the great goods of free creatures who can choose between good and evil, who can choose to be in loving relationships with each other, that's necessarily, that type of freedom is going to mean that some creatures can go awry and they can make bad decisions. They can choose to murder. They can choose to kidnap. They can choose to do horrible things, but it's still a great good to have that extent of freedom. That accounts for some of that. But then they often come back with, okay, I get that for some of the evil, but what about all the tornadoes and tsunamis and these other things of evil? And for that, I would point to, in the Christian tradition, we believe the fall of Adam and Eve actually explains why we live in a chaotic universe with chaos of natural disasters, viruses, tornadoes, and all sorts of suffering and disease. It wasn't God's original plan, but as a consequence of their sin, that's what we inherit. And they might say, oh, God, Adam and Eve, that's just a fable, right? And well, here's what we can point out. Catholic Church is very nuanced. And the first three chapters of Genesis, the Catechism says, they do contain figurative language, but they still point to a real historical event when our first parents chose to separate themselves from God. Mm-hmm. And when they did that, we inherit some of the consequences of that sin. So those are two of the points I'd make. Third point is, if there's never any evil or suffering, we actually can't get some of the great goods of courage, forgiveness, compassion, and great heroic actions that can take place in the face of evil. So I just don't share this person's intuition that it's impossible for God to exist and for evil to exist. I think you can have both. And then I go in the evidential problem, but I've been a little long-winded there. So those are just a bunch of the points I make in that chapter. Mm-hmm. As I said, it's one of the longer ones because it's one of the more serious issues.
Right, right. And then we'll look at one more. This one's in miscellaneous slogans. And this one is, do you take the Bible literally? Ha, ha, ha.
Exactly. And that's what a lot of people will say. They're like, man, you take the Bible literally, and they'll just laugh at you. Like, this is a joke. Nobody can take it seriously anymore. And I got a great question you can ask in response. I borrowed this one from Bishop Robert Barron in one of his videos or podcasts when he said this. If somebody says this, you can ask them, well, hey, do you take the library literally? You're asking me, do I take the Bible literally? I got a question for you. Do you take the library literally? And they'll be like, well, what do you mean? The library? That's like a building. It's not something I read. Well, here's what we're getting at. The Bible isn't just one book. The right. Bible is a library of all sorts of works. So it really depends. Some of the works that are historical in nature, absolutely. We'll look at that literal meaning and understand it. But other works, it contains poetry. It contains what's called, you could even say, some say the first few chapters of Genesis, they have figurative language involved. It contains proverbs. We have psalms. We have didactic teaching in Paul's letters. There's a bunch of different genres. And so sometimes we take it literally, sometimes we don't. And then you're going to get the follow-up question. Well, how do you decide which passages to take literally? And that's where, as Catholics, I think we have a great answer to this. We could say, well, first, we can look to, you know, some really prominent Bible scholars who are going to look at the author, clues around the text, historical context, literary style, and so forth. We have all these experts to help us. But secondly, as Catholics, we have the magisterium of the Church. Christ founded a church that he promised to guide into all truth, and that church gives us guidance as to certain passages and certain books that we can understand in a more literal fashion, and others that might be in a different fashion. Oh, I just thought of another genre. A lot of people think the Book of Tobit is like a long novella or like a short story almost, not meant to be taken literally, but still has a lot of good truths of faith. And now these are not all binding judgments that you have to hold, but the church provides guidance and she provides experts that can help us tackle whether or not we should take certain biblical passages literally.
Mm-hmm. Now, we just covered three slogans there out of the 20 you include in the book. It's really a phenomenal book, and if anybody out there is uncomfortable with defending their faith or has a family member or friend that asks questions and you don't have the answers to, this is a great guide that arms you with the ways to tackle those. So kudos for that, John. Where can people find your book, One Less God Than You?
Thanks, Pete. I appreciate the opportunity. I hope it serves people in their evangelism. I made a direct link at classicaltheism.com/new book. classicaltheism.com/new book. That'll send you right to the page. But if not, they can also search it on Amazon.
Excellent. John, thanks for taking time out of your schedule to spend with us. Any closing thoughts?
Closing thoughts, I just want to encourage Catholics, don't dumb down the faith. Don't worry if you don't have all the answers. There's time to learn, and we need you out there to get this message and keep passing on the faith to our young people and to others who have fallen away. So I encourage them to do that enterprisingly. Thank you.
You're welcome. And with that, you've been listening to Off the Shelf. I'm your host, Pete Sox, and Catholic Book Blogger. Until next time.
Breadbox Media Programming is brought to you by...
I actually met my wife on CatholicSingles.com, if you can believe that.
Really?
Yes, I had never done that before. Didn't have any problems with dating.
Natalie and Aaron met on CatholicSingles.com after they realized that they needed to find someone who shared their faith. Meet other faithful Catholics on the original Catholic dating site. Download our app today for free. Looking for a way to build daily prayer discipline? Seen the rise in mindfulness meditation, but not sure if it is possible to meditate in a way that's consistent with your Catholic faith? Just looking for a way to breathe new life into your existing prayer routine? No matter what you're looking for, Holo is here to help. Holo is a Catholic prayer and meditation app that helps users deepen their relationship with God through audio-guided contemplative prayer sessions. From meditations on the daily gospel, to the rosary, to daily examines, Holo has something for everyone. Holo is the number one Catholic app in the U.S. It is free to download and has permanently free content, but you can also check out all of the premium sessions for 30 days, risk-free, by signing up at www.holo.app/breadbox.